Okay.
Felix Salmon, do you give your consent to have this phone conversation taped?
I do.
Okay. My name is Bruce McWilliams. I'm with the FCIC.
My name is Alexis. Mm-hmm. Alexis Simmendinger, and I'm part of the writing team at the FCIC in the room.
And Milana Vickers, I'm one of the writers as well.
I don't know what you've heard about us in the past. We've been set up by an act of Congress to investigate the financial crisis. And we can send you a copy of that law if you wish a copy.
I think I've found it. I've had it somewhere.
Okay, that's fine. And you're required to tell the truth to us over the conversation. So,
wow.
And basically, I mean, maybe you could tell us, I mean, you did the work on, I guess, providing information about the Gaussian coupla. Maybe you could talk a little about what that is. We're not very statistically oriented here. And how that works. I mean, maybe I can focus a little more. We're working on, we were talking about CDOs and about credit rating agencies in our report. So that would be sort of the interest of, I mean, how that formula was applied that ended up causing the financial crisis from your perspective.
Okay. All right. So let's think about that and that little wired story that I did. Okay. So one of the things which I actually told Bill Angelides a few months ago is that the financial crisis in large measure was caused not by too many people taking on too much risk, but rather by too many people taking on too much safety or perceived safety in the form of AAA rated fixed income securities. So what happens is that if tell me if that makes sense to you or if that just doesn't make sense to you.
I'm not sure I understood that word you used, perceived safety.
Right. Yeah. So what you had was a huge amount of demand from, you know, sovereign wealth funds, you know, China, from SIVs at places like, you know, Citigroup and various other entities which were engaged in long-term investment, and these entities did not wanted to invest in fixed income instruments which didn't carry credit risk. So, for instance, the way that the SIVs would work is that they would borrow short and then buy long-dated AAA-rated securities, and they do that sort of maturity transformation thing and make money that way. And they wanted to make sure that to avoid the chance of losing money, that they would take on no credit risk because they only invested in AAA-rated stuff. And so there was this enormous amount of demand for anything worth carrying a AAA rating. And that demand, you know, meant that there was a lot of profit for Wall Street in taking any kind of cash flow they could find, but mostly mortgages, and structuring it in such a way that you could create AAA rated securities out of it. You know, and as you are looking into, and as you know very well, the credit rating agencies wound up making lots of money out of this, started giving AAA ratings, which used to be this unbelievably high and untouchable and perfect, and you couldn't possibly imagine. You know, these things were called bankruptcy remote, you know? Because they could, like, never declare bankruptcy. And this rating became given out willy-nilly to literally thousands of instruments by the ratings agencies, and then, you know, it became devalued, and they wound up giving this rating to a whole bunch of things, which did wind up performing very badly and defaulting and causing these enormous losses, and which we know so much about. So what we saw was, you know, certainly a certain amount of sort of, you can call it sort of stupidity on the part of investors who blindly believed the ratings agencies when they said that these AAA rated securities had no credit risk and were completely safe on that front. But for all that they were stupid in not seeing the risks, the fact is that these investors were not being greedy. If they were greedy, they would have been, you know, they weren't trying to take on those risks. They were not seeing the risks. What they wanted was safety. What they wanted was, you know, a guaranteed income stream with no credit risk attached. And that huge flight of capital into, like, there wasn't enough, basically there wasn't remotely enough in the world of sort of old-fashioned AAA bonds, you know, treasury bonds or bonds from General Electric or Johnson & Johnson or whatever, like, you know, small handful of actual AAA rated issuers, the World Bank, say. You know, there weren't nearly enough of those to meet demand for AAA rated securities, and so Wall Street found an enormous profit engine in manufacturing AAA securities through over collateralization and tranching.
Yeah.
So,
can I just ask you to clarify one thing?
Yes.
I mean, wouldn't that observation be true only if the yields or the whatever, I don't know what the right term would be, the margins on the mortgage-backed or mortgage-related CDOs, if the margin on those were the same as the margin on a more traditional bond, but in fact the margins there are higher. So you can say that it's safe because it's AAA, but your bottom line's more attractive.
Yes, certainly. I mean, you're not. There's no one is going to, like, if the spread over Treasuries on a AAA rated mortgage-backed CDO is the same as the spread over Treasuries on, say, a World Bank bond, then no one is going to buy the CDO, right? They're all going to go for the World Bank bond because it doesn't have the same sort of prepayment risk. It isn't structured. It's much, you know, it's much more liquid, and so on and so forth. So people were looking at the excess spreads on structured products, and they were treating those excess spreads as payment for illiquidity. They were not considering them to be payment for excess credit risk. There's various different things which go into the yield on a bond, and I mean, I guess in hindsight you could, you know, it's possible to say that the spreads on the bonds were the market's way of saying, oi, these things aren't nearly as risk-free as you think they are. But at the time, the investors buying them were basically saying, listen, I am a long-term investor. I have this structure myself, like, you know, either I'm a sovereign wealth fund or I'm an SIB or something like that, and I can hold these long-dated instruments to maturity. I don't need to worry about liquidity, and so I'm happy to pick up that illiquidity premium in the form of higher yields. So that was the way they were thinking.
I mean, do you have any, like, what sort of work did you do on how, let me start again. How do you explain that motivation? Why do you conclude the motivation is that they're taking money to protect against the illiquidity as opposed to taking the money because, you know, they're seeing something that has a AAA rating that ought not to, and they kind of know it.
Um, It's a good question. I think because it's hard to interrogate internal mental states after the fact. And certainly people are very good at kidding themselves about their own motivations for the doing things, especially when there's excess yield on the table. The first thing they do is pick up the excess yield, and the second thing they do is try and justify where that excess yield is coming from, right? Is there a colorful case that these investors knew or should have known that there was real credit risk in these AAA instruments?
Just to make
something clear, like if you're a small Norwegian town, right, I think the answer is clearly no. There was simply not the level of sophistication and understanding of how these things were put together and what they looked like internally for some, small municipality in Norway to really understand what the hell they were getting themselves in for. And so those people, I don't think it's fair to say that they should have known that there was credit risk there. I think they honestly thought that they were, being paid for liquidity, or they just didn't think much at all. But other investors were certainly more sophisticated. I think a lot of the, the SIBs were. And so there the question is more open.
Yeah.
But I want to just interject Milana's question. I thought she was just asking you, this is your interpretation. This is, you're extrapolating this as opposed to there having been research or data or something that we can cite, right?
I don't think you can really have data about the internal motivations and mental states.
No. What I meant was, like, for instance, there hasn't, you're not citing what was written in the prospectuses or something that's hard data. You're talking about after the fact and interpretation of what was happening.
Right.
Okay.
Right, exactly.
That's all.
Yeah. What I'm trying to do is trying to work out, like, how did this happen, broadly speaking. And it seems to me that one of the key drivers of the financial crisis was the this insatiable demand for AAA rated anything. Like, you could take a, steaming pile of nuclear waste, and as long as it carried a AAA rating, people would, happily snap it up. And what we saw was that even when the housing market faltered at the end of 2006, early 2007, and the mortgage originators started getting a lot of putbacks when their mortgages wouldn't even make their first payments, and so they all started closing their doors, and the supply of new mortgages to tranche into RMBS just trickled up to nothing. Still, there was insatiable demand for mortgage-backed AAA securities, and so and that was the main impetus behind this big uptick in CDO squares and synthetic CDOs, and all of the other desperate things that Wall Street did to try and continue to push out AAA-rated securities even after the supply of new cash flows had been, had ended. So, again, all I'm trying to say here is that, like, it's very easy to look back at that and say, you know, who were these people taking on these crazy risks of these, you know, insanely complicated and insanely structured instruments, structured products, and that makes, you know, and that's a perfectly colorable way of looking at it, but at the same time, I think that fundamentally, these people still, you know, even in 2000 to 2007, what they were doing was they were just trying to do their standard maturity transformation, yield curve plays, interest rate plays, and they would, you know, they honestly believed as long as they were invested in AAA securities, they weren't taking credit risk. A lot of them.
You're nicer than I would be to the, you know, finance. I mean, as you know, a lot of this product was held by highly sophisticated investors. In fact, you couldn't actually buy it according to SEC regulations unless you were that way. If you had bought it without a prospectus, you're more generous than me in saying.
Well, I mean, again, like, remember that when you're talking about 144A and QIBs and that kind of thing, that's true in the U.S. But a lot of the time, all that means is you wind up selling it to, you know, relatively unsophisticated German banks and Norwegian cities and that kind of thing, who, you know, these guys are not sophisticated. They really are not. In the U.S., yes.
Are you making that distinction? Are you really, I mean, because it's true, a lot of it goes to foreigners. I think, 40%. So at some point, that's that statistic I remember from some point in there. Would you really make that distinction between the overseas buyers and the U.S. ones, that they were unsophisticated and that's what makes them the buyers?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, you have sophisticated U.S. financial institutions doing all manner of magic and pushing out these AAA-rated securities at the other end, which got sold to, you know, obscure region, you know, German agricultural banks, and you know, yeah, there was a lot of greed there as well. You know, these banks were setting up, you know, bond investment arms which were bigger than the banks themselves, because they were just raking in huge profits, and they you know, because they could see that fundamentally the trade was a banking trade, right? It was maturity transformation. They had a very low cost of funds, and they could invest that very cheap capital in high-yielding AAA bonds and just make huge amounts of money off the spread. And they, you know, and so they were like, dude, it's free money, and they went in with their eyes more or less closed, frankly. I mean, they, you know, with hindsight, what they were doing was, you know, they weren't nearly skeptical enough about where these profits were coming from or what they were exactly investing in. But those European investors in particular, I think, it's hard to say that they had anything like the sophistication necessary to be able to see exactly what was going on.
Well, there's a real irony there when, you know, you see the kind of generalities of analysis, like, well, Europeans are more highly regulated, and this is a much more attractive model. I mean, if your buying's not complete in its due diligence, then
well, remember that, I mean, this is also interesting. Yeah, remember that the regulation in Europe did actually work to a large degree. Yeah, I mean, there were, as I say, you know, there are some very tragic consequences with you know, relative, with the smaller investors like those, you know, Norwegian towns and whatnot. But generally, the systemic consequences of the losses on these instruments in Europe were relatively manageable and constrained. The really big systemic consequences were all in the U.S., really, where you had, you know, the Bear Stearns and Lehman's and Countrywide and so on and so forth, and not to mention Fannie and Freddie, they... You know, if you're an investor, you know, this is what we saw in the dot-com bust in 2000. There was, you know, much more money lost in the dot-com bust than there was on subprime mortgage-backed securities. But the systemic consequences were much lighter because there was no leverage involved, you know, and you didn't have financial institutions making enormously leveraged bets on dot-com stocks. So it was investors who put, you know, $100 into the dot-com stock, and then it went to zero, and then they lost their $100, but that was the end of it. You know, with these, when as soon as you get leverage, then things become much more dangerous. I think that what you found in Europe was that most of the investors in these instruments were not actually particularly leveraged. Some of the German banks were, and then they got bailed out by the German government, and then, you know, that was part of the way that the Europeans coped.
Yeah, let's not forget those European players that got bailed out on AIG by a certain non-European bank entity.
Phyllis, can I ask you a question about this Gaussian formula? How did that?
I was still making my way slowly towards the Gaussian formula.
I apologize for the interruption.
No. So to speed things up a bit, because otherwise we're going to get absolutely nowhere here. What was absolutely crucial for getting these AAA ratings, which were, you know, as I say, which were necessary for reassuring the final investors that they weren't taking any credit risk, because they weren't, you know, wanting to take risk, was this whole process of structuring these notes, these structured products, right? And so what you then have to look at is how on earth did the banks persuade the ratings agencies that these things were AAA, that there was no credit risk, they were risk-free. And what they did was they used this whole sort of overcollateralization and tranching process, where they said, well, listen, you know, we're going to take $100 worth of mortgages, and we're just going to take the first $70 and call it AAA, so that even if there are $30 worth of mortgages, that safest tranche, the first $70, that is going to be safe, and even in the worst case scenario, you're not going to find more than $30 of losses on that $100 worth of bonds or of loans or whatever, and so therefore there's no credit risk, and you can give it a AAA rating. And the rating agencies were like, okay, we buy that. But the key thing here, of course, is especially when you start taking the, you know, mezzanine tranches of other CDOs rather than mortgages. But even when you're just taking mortgages, what you need to ensure when you're looking at these structures is that you have very low correlations between all of the different things that you're throwing into the pool and then securitizing. So, you know, if you have 100 mortgages in the pool and they all, they will all either perform or they will all default together, then you get no diversification, And there's no point in saying that, you know, the first 70% of the cash flow of the AAA, because there will never be more than $30 of losses on that pool. You know, if they all perform together, if they're all completely correlated, then either the entire pool performs and the whole thing, you know, pays off, or else they all default and nothing pays off, in which case no one gets any cash, not, you know, regardless of their status in the water pool, right?
And how can people miss that along the way?
Well, they didn't miss that. I mean, okay, so this is, they knew full well that correlation was absolutely crucial. And so what they needed was a way of measuring correlation and determining whether or not there was sufficient diversification in the pool to make investors comfortable, and when I say investors, I mean the credit rating agencies, to make the ratings agencies comfortable that, you know, there's enough diversification there that you can that you can get that AAA rating. So when I say that people knew about this, there were desks in investment banks of correlation traders. There were people whose entire job was to do nothing but trade correlation. So it's not like this was an unknown thing. This is absolutely central to the entire process, right? Was calculating and trading and determining correlations, and it was absolutely known and understood that the value of these bonds was highly contingent on the correlations which were underlying them. And so that brings us to the Gaussian copula function, because the fact is that correlation is basically fundamentally impossible to measure. And so what they were trying
Why do you say that? It's fundamentally impossible to measure.
Okay, there are two reasons for that. The first reason is that you're trying to reduce an enormous set of relationships and probabilistic relationships down to a single number. And the second reason is that, as the cliche puts it, in a crisis all correlations go to one, right?
Yeah.
So, but the, you know, if I was to say to you, you know, if I was to create a CDO with just two mortgages inside it, and I was to say to you, so what's the correlation between those two mortgages? Like, how do you measure that? You're taking two mortgages, and one, they're brand new mortgages, so they don't have much payment history, and two, even if they do have payment history, almost by definition, by the time you're selling it, both of those mortgages have made all of their payments in full and on time. So, you know, what you're saying is, is there diversification now that you have two mortgages rather than one? And how are you meant to measure that? It's really hard. So, you know, and it just becomes harder when you increase the number of mortgages in the pool. So, you know, you put in 100 or 1,000, and then you have loads of correlations and cross-correlations within that pool.
But, you know, people who were shorting knew early on that geographic diversity, for example, would have been important. And so if they were shorting, they were looking for products that lacked that geographical diversity. You know, they were going for the...
Exactly. What they were doing, people who were shorting, were looking to short the the products which had the highest correlations, right? So, you know, as I say, like, everyone knew this. Everyone knew that correlation was fatal to all of these instruments. And so if you were looking to short these bonds, you would want to look at the ones with the highest correlations. And so you would go out and try and look for the bonds for, you know, with lots of mortgages from the sand states, because you reckon that they all basically had the same economic fundamentals and that the mortgages would perform in line with each other. And when you have anything performing in line with each other, you get a high correlation and therefore a much greater chance of default on the structured product.
So
yeah, absolutely, people understood this.
So I mean, and forgive me, I'm not, you know, completely familiar with all your writing, but I mean, did you know, when you say correlation is fundamentally impossible to measure, it almost, even if that's mathematically true, it almost seems as though one could use that as an excuse for banks sort of blithely skipping over this detail of needing to.
Oh, absolutely not. No. Quite the opposite. The difficulty in measuring correlation was the whole reason why this market should never have existed in the first place. It's the whole reason why these bonds should never have been given AAA ratings in the first place. And it's like, if you can't be sure that the correlations are low, you can't give these instruments a AAA rating, because the entire rating is contingent on the existence of a low correlation. If there's a high correlation there, then you can't get that AAA rating. And since correlations are impossible to measure, you can't be sure that there's a low correlation there. If there's a possibility that the correlation is much higher than you think, then you cannot give out that rating.
So what do you think of post-crisis structured investment products and whether that's been addressed?
Well, I mean, you've seen the re-remix, right?
Mm-hmm.
There was a farce.
Yeah.
Yeah, after everything blew up, after everyone understood why and how everything blew up, they did these re-remix, and they assigned AAA ratings to the re-remix, and then those blew up. It's hilarious.
Can you do, I wonder if you are either doing work on this, or you can direct us to any sort of interesting analysis of product that's still out there. Because, of course, this is, I mean, the IMF has done some stuff on it, and individual banks have, but, I mean, those values for the existing products and for upcoming ones is, of course, a big mystery.
Right. I mean, I would definitely, I mean, I'm hoping and assuming that you guys are asking the credit rating agency some very tough questions about the re-remix.
Sure.
Because those re-remix, to me, say that the ratings agencies learned nothing from this crisis.
Yeah.
And how on earth did they manage to get those AAA ratings on the re-remix, even after everything that they ostensibly had learned in the crisis about, you know, because I don't even see, there wasn't a crisis. This is the crazy thing, right? After the re-remix were structured and released, there was no crisis. There was no crazy thing where correlations went to one. There was no, you know, crazy black swan event which blew up an entire asset class. There was none of that. In fact, bonds, you know, rallied. The entire structured product world did very well. Fixed income world did very well.
I have my theories.
So how on earth did you, sorry?
I have my theories on why. What's yours?
Oh, tell me, honestly, why did the re-remix blow up? I don't know. It makes no sense to me at all.
You don't think it has anything to do with sovereign guarantees? Well, let me, or you don't think it has anything to
guarantee?
Well, government backing, I guess, is what I mean.
I don't think there was any government backing of the securities in the re-remix.
And no, not per se, but there could be a perception of one, or do you not think so? That should we have a should we have a sequel that we would have intervention, and consequently the steps leading up to that explosion, even though they seem like inevitable steps, we just wouldn't get there because we'd have massive intervention again.
Right. I mean, I guess maybe. I mean, I guess what you're saying is that the credit rating agencies could give a AAA rating to the re-remix on the grounds that if there was another crisis, there would be another bailout, and therefore the moral hazard trade would basically, you know, allow that rating. Which, I mean, I don't know if you how broad-ranging this whole investigation is. I hope it's quite broad. And I hope that at some point in your report you mentioned the fabulous thing which Moody's did at the beginning of 2007 when they gave all of the banks in Iceland the AAA rating briefly for like a few days before they changed their mind. And that AAA rating, if you go back to the Moody's report where they did that, was entirely based on a moral hazard argument. They were like, these banks are so important to the government that if they ever get into trouble, then the government will bail them out. You know, and of course, Moody's never stopped to wonder whether the Icelandic government could actually afford to bail out banks, which were collectively, you know, many times the size of the entire Icelandic economy. But that was, you're quite right that the ratings agencies do make explicit moral hazard assumptions at times. But I don't think that that was what was going on with the re-remix.
What do you think was going on?
I think they were, you know, I think it's, they were just... still, even after the crisis, far too credulous when it came to judging the quality of the assets which were in these, you know, mortgage-backed structures. That they just still couldn't bring themselves to accept that a lot of the data which they were going on was really flawed and that they couldn't believe it. That's my guess, but that's literally just my guess. I haven't, you know, looked at the prospectuses of these things. I haven't understood. It is one of the bigger questions in my mind. Like, how could they have learned so little? But remember as well, one of the things which, you know, Treasury talks about still, on a pretty regular basis is the importance to the economy as a whole of getting the securitization market back on track, because, you know, how are we ever going to be able to get the economy growing unless there's all of the securitization flows which we saw over the past 15 years. So there's definitely a kind of official sector impetus, you know, there's a definitely feeling in the official sector that the securitization can and should be part of the solution as well as being part of the problem. And this is where the Gaussian calculus comes back in, is that one of the most fundamental pillars upon which the securitization concept is based is this idea that you can be comfortable with measuring and quantifying correlation, and that you can then go ahead and get be comfortable about the low risk of the senior tranches on the grounds that you know what the correlations are and you have the requisite diversification and so on and so forth. And what my article in Wired was trying to do was to explain how the, you know, all of that reasoning was incredibly flawed, that, you know, obviously not only the correlations will go to one in crisis, but just the way they were measuring correlation was insane. And it was based on looking at CDS spreads in a market for credit default swaps, which was only a few years old. And what you're trying to do is measure correlations over...
I'm sorry, they were looking at CDS spreads instead of what?
Well, that's the only spread they could look at, right? So what they were doing when, is that they based this entire argument on the idea that if you look at CDS spreads over time, that the CDS spreads will give you a really good idea of the credit risk on these instruments, and this, of course, is, you know, faulty assumption number one, and that then you can look at the way that those CDS spreads behaved in relation to each other over the past 2.5 years or whatever, and say, oh, look, they moved in different directions, therefore there's no correlation there over the next 30 years.
That's right. I do remember that. I remember that. Okay.
And you're like, excuse me? What? And but what happens is, you know, is the David Lee and the people who put together the Gaussian calculus function, they created this beautiful formula, which, you know, I splashed over on the cover of Wired magazine, is the formula that destroyed Wall Street. And it had this lovely equal sign in the middle of it, right? And you're like, oh, this equals that. And then, you know, and of course, all of the people on Wall Street, the quants and the geeks, they all have this massive physics envy. And they love looking at formulas with equal signs in the middle of it and just saying, oh, well, there's a formula. You know, if it has an equal sign in the middle of it, then the thing on the left has to equal the thing on the right, and you stop thinking about the human nature of markets and the necessary uncertainty there, and you would occasionally have, you know, sort of high level, you know, graviers to the top of banks going, oh, you know, you realize there's a lot of uncertainty here. It's not just a mathematical equivalence. And everyone would go, oh, yes, absolutely. And then they would completely ignore that and go ahead as though, you know, what was being pumped out the other end of this Gaussian calculus function was some kind of mathematically certain thing rather than just a hint about where correlations might be. And then they would, you know, and the ratings agencies, but also the people structuring the bonds, put far too much faith in this formula, which was, you know, it massively oversimplified matters to positively an extremely harmful degree. You know, when you're talking about a set of probability distributions which is enormous and incredibly intractable, and then you suddenly somehow manage to dump all of these probability distributions into one really simple little formula which pumps out a beautiful little number between minus one and plus one at the end, and it all gets reduced to this one number. You know, it's a bit like, you know, the value at risk thing. You know, people put way too much store in their VAR numbers, despite the fact that they knew, you know, perfectly well. You know, even if you have a 99% VAR, and most people are using 95% VAR, but even if you have a 99% VAR, that still means that 3 or 4 days a year, you could have massive losses much bigger than that. You know, but people forget this because it's a number. And so one of the ways I try to explain this, what happened, is that value at risk was a way of allowing banks to ignore the tails, and then the Gaussian calculus function was a way of allowing banks to shove enormous amounts of risk into those tails. And then you put the two together, and it's absolutely disastrous. That, you know, banks banks historically were okay. It was okay historically if banks ignored the tails because the tails were relatively thin. But then as you had more people using things like the Gaussian copula function to massively increase the amount of tail risk in the system, you know, at that point the use of VAR became increasingly dangerous because, you know, the minute you had a tail event, it became much more systemically destabilizing.
Now, you talked earlier about how you still saw that after the initial crisis, you still saw that in the re-remix. And then can you give examples of where you maybe still see it to this day?
It's hard to distinguish a lot of different things at the time. So, for instance, you know, if I'm looking at the large amount of European sovereign debt which is sitting on the balance sheets of big European banks, is that ignoring tail risks or is that piling into a moral hazard trade? You know, I don't know, you can think about it both ways, I guess.
I guess maybe I ought to have put it another way. You know, of course, banks now say they're more focused on tail risk, etc. But as you point out, there's this competing pressure to have a securitization market that's worth something. So
I don't believe them for a minute. The banks all said they were highly concentrated on tail risk even before the crisis.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, Bob Rubin being an absolutely prime example of the way in which you just cannot believe anything that anybody says, right? Bob Rubin was made his career, like basically rose his way up the ranks at Goldman Sachs as an arbitrageur. And what he did essentially was make hundreds of millions of dollars for Goldman Sachs, and or if not billions of dollars for Goldman Sachs and millions of dollars for himself, by making very large leveraged bets that things which were 95% likely to happen were going to happen. And that's a great trade nearly all of the time. And it's such a great trade that he made lots and lots of money doing it and became CEO of Goldman Sachs. And all the while, the way you do that trade really well is by shouting very, very loudly about how sophisticated your risk management functions are and how all you do is stay up at night worrying about tail risk and how you worry so much about tail risk and it's the only thing you worry about and it's the one thing which you place more emphasis on than anything else and yada, 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 right? And so people learn from that. And so, you know, you would go along to Bear Stearns or Lehman Brothers or Fannie Mae and you would ask them about tail events and tail risk, and they would say, oh, yes, 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 we have unbelievably sophisticated risk management functions and we are always staying up at night worrying about this and we care about it very much and we know about it very much and we're incredibly sophisticated when it comes to it. And then they would just go ahead and behave as though they were, you know, it was non-existent. And you have to look at what people do rather than what they say. Because the one thing which we've really learned over the course of the financial crisis is that when people say that their risk management function is incredibly sophisticated, most of the time they're lying.
Right. Well, I mean, the one example of Goldman Sachs in this case famously did pay attention to tail risk and did get out of the market in December 2006. I mean, that's the famous instance where they did pay attention to their VARs. And
That was actually when the market started going down. They were like, oh, you know, they saw five consecutive days of losses, and they were like, we're losing money here, people. Let's get out of this money. Let's get out of this market. And they were small enough and nimble enough to be able to do that trade. They were never warehousing the level of mortgages and mortgage securities on their own books that the really big banks like Merrill Lynch or Citigroup or UBS or any of those guys were, right? So in order to get back, in order to put on a short trade to make up for whatever mortgage assets they had on their balance sheet, they could, you know, they were able to do that. A bigger bank, even if it did have a sophisticated risk management function, would never have been able to do that because the size of the assets was so enormous. But if you go back to the Rubin SCIC testimony, you know, he was saying, listen, we had all of these liquidity puts, you know, these contingent liabilities, which were absolutely enormous and which no one ever quantified and which were completely ignored. And we had all of these super senior securities and they were meant to be even safer than AAA, and AAA was completely safe, so we didn't even worry about it. This is Bob Rubin, Mr. Fucking all I ever do is care about tail risk and it keeps me up at night. And he's like, yeah, well, it was quadruple A, you know. We thought the risk was de minimis.
Right.
So, if he can't do it, who can? You know, and of course the group and everyone else, you know, Tommy Maharis and everyone, like, oh, yeah, we're unbelievably sophisticated risk management functions, yada, yada, yada. And all of the, you know, hedge funds, look at every single hedge fund which has ever blown up, and they'll all tell you that it has a sophisticated risk management function. They don't. And one of the things which is still open is the degree to which there is such a thing as a sophisticated risk management function. You know, can you, you know, if you hire a really good chief risk officer and you give them, you know, a seat on the board and lots of like very high level representation and all the rest of it, you know, is it possible to protect against tail risk? Is tail risk hedging something which is even possible? And I suspect the answer is no. And the reason why banks protest so much that they are doing it is precisely that they aren't and that they can't.
And is that, does that lead you to the best you can do is have capital standards that keep you from getting into too much trouble?
Is that the best you can do? I don't know if that's the best you can do, but it certainly helps. The one thing which we've absolutely learned time and time again, and you can't learn this thing too many times, you just have to, the only thing which causes major systemic meltdown is leverage. It's always leverage, and it always has been leverage, and it always will be leverage. And so if you reduce the amount of leverage, then you reduce the amount of systemic risk. That's all, always and ever true. So yes, if insofar as you implement stronger capital adequacy standards and, cap leverage ratios, definitely that helps in reducing tail risk. So that's why it's always a little bit difficult to take banks or hedge funds face value when they're telling you that they're concentrated on tail risk, and meanwhile their leverage ratio is going through the roof.
I'm afraid I got to step out of the room. Maybe Bruce wants to continue it. Thanks very much for all your answers. That was very interesting.
We can sort of wrap it up. I forgot at the beginning of the interview we have a protocol to ask you your background. So maybe you can sort of quickly summarize your background.
I started started writing about bonds, basically, in 1995 for Euromoney, and continued writing about bonds for the following 15 years in various different places. I was historically very much coming at this from a sort of trade mag, insidery, not very big picture, just on a sort of like deal by deal basis point of view, to the point at which I was actually, you know, in early 2007, I was defending these horribly indefensible CPDOs and things like that, because I sort of drank the Kool-Aid. But when it all fell apart, I understood, you know, what it was that, where it was that I'd gone wrong. So, yeah, I mean, I didn't, you know, I didn't have these opinions about the disconnect between what banks say and what's actually true until after it was far too late. You know, I was one of these people who used to believe Matt Banks when they talked about sophisticated risk management functions, and I used to believe in the ability of Monte Carlo simulations to actually pick up on, you know, potential problems. And I used to believe credit rating agencies when they said that something was with AAA and never defaulted, and so on and so forth. So, yeah, I wasn't remotely prescient about any of this. So, I was involved in that. I used to talk to these people, and I used to, you know, and so now, with hindsight, it all kind of falls into place.
Right. Well, in your defense, you're a journalist, and so you weren't being paid to capture the tail risk, as you say. And that was the investment bank's job, and they were being paid for that.
So. Yeah, but we're all like paraphysical on the appeal. You know? It's, you know, without nice financial industry profits, there's no financial journalism.
All right. Now, I used to live in London. I after when the .com crash happened, I had to leave. So.
Right.
Great. I appreciate your time very much. Thanks a lot.
Well, it's a pleasure.
Okay. Thanks for your help.
Thanks for doing this.
Okay. Thanks for your help.
Bye. Bye.